DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, deep and dirty in the world of science and technology as ever. I'm Zulfi Karabani, and coming up, how to help autistic kids improve social interaction with virtual objects and a boy called Andy.
The interaction with the environment and with Andy is facilitated through a touch screen. It's a multi-touch, large 42-inch multi-touch screen. And the idea is that these objects provide triggers for social interaction.
Also on the programme, European data protection agencies take aim at Google again. And
we've had a confirmed shark sighting this morning. If you could please stay out of the water.
Well, we're all scared of them, but scientists in Western Australia say we just don't know anything about them. That is, unless you stay right here and keep listening to Spectrum. But first, to the science in the environment. As a civil trial over the Deepwater Horizon disaster prepared to get underway this Monday, the 25th of February in New Orleans, attention has returned to the recovery process. People working in the local fishing industry, residents and other local business people are hoping to be awarded compensation because the catastrophe 3 years ago resulted in up to 1 million tonnes of crude oil flowing into the waters of the Gulf of Mexico. But today there's hardly any evidence of it. So where's all the oil gone? Fabian Schmidt has been speaking to German marine scientists to find out about the chemical and biological processes behind its disappearance. Jesse Wingard has his report.
When BP's Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico, 11 workers died and millions of barrels of oil leaked into the waters. It was a disaster for local seabirds, marine mammals and turtles. Many died after they were covered in the sticky oil. Even during the clean-up process, some nesting places were damaged. 3 years on, it seems things are back to normal. At least, there's hardly any oil to see. But just because it's hard to see the oil, it doesn't mean it's all gone. When a tanker splits its sides, you tend to see large clots of oil on the surface of the water. But with the Deepwater Horizon disaster, much of the oil stayed in the depths of the ocean. Antje Bortius is a biologist at the Alfred Wegener Institute for Polar and Marine Research.
The oil reservoir had such an incredible negative pressure or vacuum, and so it was all sprayed through a very thin pipe in the finest droplets. The drops, they were just a thousandth of a millimeter in size, had such a large surface area compared to their buoyancy that they were unable to rise. All they could do was drift with the mass of water.
These drops then combined with suspended matter, such as plankton and minerals, at a depth of 1,000 or 2,000 metres. They clumped and then sank to the ocean bed, where they formed a fluffy carpet of oil.
It looks like dust bunnies at home when you haven't hoovered for a while, but they're red and brown. And this has been found on the ocean bed and on deep-sea corals.
Oil is almost constantly and naturally discharged in the Gulf of Mexico. And this means that there are bacteria in the Gulf which can digest oil with special enzymes. This community of bacteria is now slowly working its way through the carpet of oil that was created by the Deepwater Horizon explosion. That's good because the oil is slowly disappearing. But it can lead to toxicity. Detlef Schulz-Bull, a chemist at the Leibniz Institute, explains.
Part of the oil consists of a highly poisonous compound, which decomposes very slowly. And when this interacts with the bacteria, it's even harder to evaluate its toxicity. But both the toxicity and the compound's complexity probably increase.
Und die Toxizität nimmt vermutlich auch zu.
The main problem is that the bacterial decomposition products, such as the fatty acids, are far more water-soluble. And organisms ingest them quicker too, so they quickly end up in the food chain. The other problem is that the bacteria need a lot of oxygen, and that can lead to an oxygen deficiency in the ocean. This, in turn, gives rise to other bacteria which do not need oxygen. Here's the microbiologist Antje Bortius again.
The
second group of bacteria produce sulfide, resulting in hydrogen sulfide. But this sulfide is bad for the sea worms, shellfish, and other fish.
That's why, to begin with, the biologists were concerned that the marine ecosystem at the Gulf of Mexico would collapse. But this hasn't happened because the Gulf's strong currents ensure that there's a constant oxygen feed. The current also dilutes the oil and the decomposition products produced by the bacteria. However, it has also become clear that the recovery workers may have made a mistake in using the solvent Corex to stop the oil reaching the coast on the water's surface. What happened was that the oil and the Corex both dissolved into the water, which poisoned bacteria, fish larvae and microorganisms. The chemist, Schultz Bull, draws the obvious conclusion that we shouldn't use solvents to deal with oil catastrophes.
You can't see the oil, but it's still there. And all you're doing is pouring chemicals into the ecosystem that are highly toxic. You're not helping anything.
Instead, the one thing that does help is an oil barrier. Then pump off the oil. And if that doesn't work, we should be using special wood materials and try and get the oil to stick at the water's surface.
Jesse Wingard with that report there by Fabian Schmidt. Now, biologists say they've found the key to a new anti-malarial drug which kills the parasite with a salt overdose. It's the first new discovery in the fight against malaria in 20 years. Professor Kieran Kirk and his team at the Australian National University worked with researchers from the United States and Singapore to make the discovery. When I spoke to him, Professor Kirk told me that understanding how the drug works will enable researchers to track its long-term effectiveness and to detect whether the malaria parasite develops resistance.
So the work was actually done by a student, Natalie Spillman, who spent 4 years researching this, and we started with some basic biology questions. We knew the parasite invaded red blood cells and grew inside the red blood cell. We knew the red blood cells full of salt, and we just wondered how the parasite dealt with that. And what Natalie showed was that the parasite's actually very leaky. The salt comes pouring in, but then it has a very effective molecular pump that sends the salt out again. So the parasite is all the time pumping salt out. We identified the particular protein that we thought was responsible. And we did this finished this bit of work about 18 months ago, and then almost the same week, a paper came out from a consortium based in Singapore in the United States, and they had developed a new class of anti-malarial drug. They had discovered it. They knew that a particular protein played some sort of role, but they didn't know how the drug worked. They didn't know what the protein's role was. And as soon as we looked at the protein, we recognized it was our salt pump. So we then got together with the groups from Singapore and the US, and sure enough, they sent us their compound, their new anti-malarial drug, and sure enough, it was a very effective blocker of the salt pump, and as soon as you added it to the parasite, within minutes, the parasite immediately filled up with salt. So we realized then that we now understood how this new drug works. The drug works by stopping the salt pump, parasite fills up with salt in it, and it dies.
That's a fantastic example of collaboration, international collaboration, isn't it?
It is, yes.
And it's the first real discovery in what, two decades, about 20 years, isn't it? Building
well, what
up
what
on
it
this.
In terms of the newness, so the drug is actually in quite advanced clinical trials now. Novartis is putting it into it's in phase two clinical trials. They're treating patients who have malaria just to see if the drug works. And where the newness comes in is that there are clinical trials going on all the time, but this is actually the first genuinely new chemical structure that we've had that kills malaria parasites that has got this far, that has got into advanced clinical trials for 20 years. Up until now, it tends to be combinations of old drugs combined in novel ways, chemical modifications of drugs that we've known for some time that have worked. But this is brand new. This has never been used before, and this is why it's quite exciting, because it is a brand new way to kill parasites, and we now know how it kills parasites.
We have, of course, seen over the years malaria evolve and develop resistance to existing drugs. You mentioned some of the sort of the mixtures of drugs there that are used at the moment.
Yes.
What are the chances of, say, the malaria parasite, might move to other parts of our blood circulation system, so it moves away from the red blood cells and decides to sit somewhere else? Is that totally unrealistic, or what are the chances?
Look, I think that the parasite won't do that. The parasite and us have been together for many, many millions of years, and the parasite is very highly adapted to living inside our red blood cells. But you're quite right. What it can do, and what it has done, what it has always done. Each time we've had a new malaria drug, either quickly or sometimes over a longer period, it has developed resistance. So it stays inside the red blood cell. It's always going to be a red blood cell parasite, but it can change, it can mutate in ways that make it ultimately resistant to the drugs we use. And so far, history tells us every drug we've developed, just about, maybe every drug, the parasite has shown it's been able to become resistant. And that's the worry with any new anti-malarial. If this one goes through into the field, the next question will be, will the parasite become resistant? And that's why understanding the mechanism is a major advantage, because if we know how the drug works, we can then look at the parasite, see if the drug's continuing to work. Is the parasite able to change its pump so that our compounds don't block it anymore? That's the sort of questions we can ask. It gives us an advantage. This won't eradicate malaria, but understanding this gives us an advantage in this sort of constant us against the parasite with it developing resistance and us developing new drugs.
And this, of course, would be relevant for malaria around the globe, wouldn't it? I mean, there aren't sort of types of malaria where this wouldn't be relevant.
Well, that's the hope. There are different types of malaria. I mean, humans get 5 different types of malaria. There's one that Plasmodium falciparum is the one that kills most people. It's currently being tested against that most deadly, the most virulent of the parasites. All the indications are good that this will be effective very broadly, perhaps against the other types as well. So the hope is that if it goes through the clinical trial successfully, it would be a drug that would apply throughout the tropical world, everywhere there is malaria.
Professor Kieran Kirk of the Australian National University there. And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW Online. We're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, always follow us at DW_SciTech. Now, the use of technology in the classroom is perhaps nothing new, but a UK primary school is now breaking new ground by using technology to help pupils with autism communicate with their surroundings. It's all part of a study being prepared for publication this spring, looking at how interactive virtual characters might help autistic children with some poorly developed social skills adapt to the real world. Lars Bevanger reports from Birmingham.
Hello.
This is Topcliff Primary School in Birmingham, England. It looks and sounds very much like an ordinary school, but around 50 of its 250 pupils have various degrees of autism.
A child with autism can be very locked in, let alone self-directed.
Sarah Quickenden is one of the teachers working with the autistic children at Topcliff.
And it's the locked-in children that we find most difficult to motivate into exploring their social skills, because they do have social skills. It's just a matter of them having the opportunity to share that with somebody next to them or that they want to actually interact with.
Good job.
So this is Andy. He's a virtual character.
And that somebody doesn't need to be another human being. Meet Andy, a virtual boy living in a virtual world in a programme called Echoes. His creator is Dr. Kaska Porajska-Pomsta from the Institute of Education at the London Knowledge Lab.
The interaction with the environment and with Andy is facilitated through a touch screen. It's a multi-touch, large 42-inch multi-touch screen, and children can manipulate different objects within this environment. For example, there are pots that they can stack or flowers that they can pick. They can shake a cloud and it will produce rain and grow more flowers. And the idea is that these objects provide triggers for social interaction.
If you've ever played on a Wii console or with Kinect technology, you can imagine how the interaction works. The children react to what's happening on the screen, while the program reacts to the children's movements and voices. Children with autism sometimes find it hard to interact with real people, but often have few barriers when it comes to virtual characters, like Andy. Dr. Porajska-Pomsta hopes Andy can teach the children the skills they need before they apply them to the real world and real people.
There are a lot of important skills that children need to learn in order to engage in successful social interaction. For example, being able to follow the gaze of others in order to understand what another person may think or intend. And these are really the fundamentals of communication.
Hello. How are you? It's me.
Ian Lowe is the headmaster at Topcliffe Primary School. He takes pride in the way his school integrates pupils with autism into the ordinary school day and feels the Echoes project and the Andy character is helping him do that.
One piece of technology, you know, isn't a cure for autism, and it wasn't a sole solution for dealing with everyone's needs. But what it does do is support children in communication. The benefit for us has been children who have been struggling with communication issues engage with Andy. You know, in fact, if Andy hasn't worked, in inverted commas, the children are still asking him to come onto the screen or telling him to get a move on or something like that. So they have completely bought into the Andy character. Therefore, they are having dialogue with Andy and communication with Andy, which is then they can be able to take on into the classroom.
Teachers and parents say they've seen positive changes in the children who've been involved with the Echoes project and Andy, the virtual character. Project leader Kaska Porajska-Pomster is very pleased with the outcome so far.
Seeing children interacting with technology that you have dreamt out is absolutely magic in itself, and there is so much that we can learn from it. It is absolutely essential to engage children and teachers at different stages in the development of technology to make it relevant to their needs.
I need to go home now.
The first stage of the Echoes project is now concluded, and a report detailing the findings is due to be published shortly. Several other European countries have shown an interest in adopting the technology, and it's also due to be rolled out in India. The next step is a mobile application featuring Andy, the virtual boy, which will allow pupils to use portable devices, like tablets, to interact even more easily. Lars Bavanga, DW, Birmingham.
Bye-bye, Andy.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Once again, Google may be about to find itself in potentially hot water with EU data protection agencies. European data regulators have threatened to take action over the internet giant's privacy policy. The policy was recently consolidated and now allows Google to pool user data from all of its services, ranging from YouTube to Gmail. While the European DPAs are driving the new action, the European Commission is also pushing to massively increase how much it can fine companies like Google, which until now, and I quote, have been able to laugh off infringement fines. Chiponda Chimbelu has this report.
European data protection authorities are not happy with Google. The internet giant missed a very important deadline this month. It was supposed to bring its privacy policy in line with EU data protection laws by February 15th. That was the deadline after Google was told in October last year that it had 4 months to stop collecting so much information on its users. But the internet giant hasn't made any changes, according to the EU and French data protection authority CNIL. We tried to speak to Google, but they only sent us this statement via email from their spokesperson, Al Verney. Here it is, read by Jesse Wingard.
Our privacy policy respects European law and allows us to create simpler, more effective services. We have engaged fully with the CNIL throughout this process and will continue to do so going forward.
Well, if things continue as they are, the EU may have to crack its whip. French data protection authority CNIL is coordinating how the EU's data protection agencies react to Google's failure to meet the deadline. Gwenda Legrand is the head of the IT experts department at CNIL.
We ask for more information and we ask for more user control. In some cases, it's a consent, it's an opt-in by the users. In some cases, it's just an opt-out.
In March 2012, Google combined 60 privacy policies into one. The change allowed it to collect information on individual users across services like online video streaming site YouTube, image organizer Picasa, and email service Gmail. But this makes it harder for users to tell how and when Google is collecting information from them, as Legrand explains.
If you have personalized results in the search, which are done based on your user history, for instance, in that case, it's absolutely not transparent for the user.
And the problem, as Legrand mentions earlier, is that users never got the opportunity to opt in or out of Google's altered privacy policy in March 2012. In fact, for any user who felt that they weren't happy with the new policy, the only option was to stop using Google services. This is why the EU stepped in last October.
We made a number of recommendations to Google in that letter, asking Google to change the way the services were provided to give more user control and better information to the users.
And now that Google has failed to meet the deadline, the EU intends to take action by the summer. The internet giant could end up being fined, as Gwendal Legrand from the French data protection agency CNIL explains.
In France, for instance, we can get fines up to 150,000 euros and 300,000 euros in case of repeated offense.
150,000 euros. That's nothing for Google. Its revenue last year exceeded $50 billion, which is close to 38 billion euros. 150,000 euros would hardly make a dent in Google's annual revenue. Fortunately, the EU feels the same way. Mina Andreeva is a spokesperson for the Justice, Fundamental Rights and Citizenship Commission in Brussels.
Today, there are often no sanctions at all, or they are so low that infringers basically pay the fine, laugh at the law and continue their breaches. Google has done nothing to address all the recommendations of the French data protection regulator, so this means they are ignoring all the warnings of the regulator. But when a regulator has the tool of a fine, which can run up to 2% of the worldwide annual turnover, which in the case of Google could be up to $1 billion US dollar based on the 2012 annual revenue, well, that is a real deterrent and that might work.
Google versus European data protection authorities is a test case for the EU. In April, the European Parliament Civil Liberties Committee will vote on the proposal that would increase the fines for data protection violation on the continent. The whole European Parliament is set to vote on it later this year. And the proposal won't only help consumers by protecting their data, it will also help companies, Mina Andreeva says.
They don't want to deal with 27 different rules that cost them today $2.3 billion per year just to get acquainted with all the different national laws if they want to do business on the European market.
According to Andreeva, one law for the EU will also prevent companies from moving servers from one country to another so as to benefit from loopholes in EU states with less restrictive data protection laws. So the law won't just be about harmonizing practices in Europe. It is also about protecting countries and allowing them to compete on an equal footing.
Chiponda Chimelu there. Now, they say you should perhaps start as you mean to finish, or words to that effect, so we're going to return to the science and the environment now. There have been an unprecedented number of fatal shark attacks and shark sightings off Australia's western coast in the past 2 years, and while the attacks have taken their toll on tourism, one group at least is benefiting. That's the sharks themselves. Currently, scientists don't know much about the sharks in the region, partly because Western Australia is so vast and isolated. But with swimmers, surfers and divers demanding to know why the attacks are increasing and what they can do about them, researchers are now taking a closer look at the sharks. Kate Hairsine reports from the Western Australian capital of Perth.
It is a perfect summer's morning here at Scarborough, one of Perth's most popular surf beaches. The solid swells attracted quite a few early morning surfers, myself included. As I head down to the water, the Shark Patrol helicopter starts to hover ominously overhead. It's a bad sign.
We've had a confirmed shark sighting this morning. Please stay out of the water.
Alerted by the shark alarm, the surfers are quick to paddle out of the water. One of them is John DiCarlo, who's been coming to this beach for over 40 years.
Do you have a feeling now that there's more shark alarms than when you were here growing up?
I don't have a feeling. I know there's more shark alarms now than when I was growing up, absolutely.
How was it when you were a kid?
As far as shark alarms, it was like a novelty. It would be once or twice a year, and now it's like three times a week.
The number of sharks sighted off the West Australian coast might have increased, but no one actually knows what this means. Are there more sharks around? Or have shark numbers actually stayed the same? It's just that the sharks have changed their behaviour. Or is it that, sensitised by the media, more people are actually reporting shark sightings? The problem is that there is just no hard data. There have been virtually no stock assessments of sharks here, until now, that is.
Well, the one that most people are worried about is the great white shark. That's the one from films, and that's been associated with 5 attacks over the last 18 months now, which is fairly unprecedented in our history.
That's Dr. Rick Fletcher. He's the Executive Director of Research at the Department of Fisheries Western Australia. In the past year, the department has started a great white research project. So far, researchers have tagged 110 animals and taken genetic samples at the same time.
Through time, we'll build up an understanding of the genetic diversity of the sharks that we're catching and whether or not just a simple mark recapture, how many sharks are we recapturing, are we recapturing the same one? And through that, through time, we might be able to come up with a population estimate. But that's likely to be 5 to 10 years, not 1 or 2 years.
The tagging project will also map the great white's movements and try and find out if they favour certain locations under certain conditions.
A lot of the information we've got so far from the satellite tagging is of one shark over a period of time. What we're looking for is how does that behaviour change between years, and is that then correlated with some type of oceanographic conditions? And if we can get some understanding of whether it's correlated with that, then we might get a better understanding of when the risk in different areas is going to be higher or lower.
Back at the beach, I've organised to meet Dr. Nathan Hart. He's not only an avid beachgoer, he's a neurobiologist at the Oceans Institute at the University of Western Australia. He and other scientists at the Institute have quite a unique area of research. They study shark sensory systems, and they've just won a funding grant to research shark deterrence, a hot topic in a country where 85% of people live within 50 kilometres of the coast.
We're trying to understand as much as we can about how the shark senses the world around it and then try and use what we know to manipulate their behaviour.
The Institute's going to look at things such as whether certain sounds or chemicals can scare off sharks, and they'll also examine potential deterrents like bubble curtains, which are already used to guide fish away from intakes at power stations. Hart is particularly partial to the idea of strobe lights as a potential shark deterrent.
It's a nice way which can be deployed in the ocean. It has no lasting effects and can potentially be deployed in different ways, on a surfboard, on an individual swimmer, on buoys situated off the beach. So I think that has a lot of promise if it works.
Some of the ideas might sound simple, but the research is complex, involving studies of sharks' physiology and their reactions in the Institute's aquarium. To make it even more complicated, the scientists have to test if a particular deterrent will work for a wide range of shark species.
Take the white shark and the bull shark, for example. They have very different life histories. They feed on different things. The bull shark will go into fresh water, the white shark won't. So quite different biology, and the sensory systems are designed in different ways. But there are important differences which may influence behaviour, and so we need to make sure we're covering all bases.
The Shark Patrol helicopter gives the all clear, and the beach opens again to swimmers. It seems that until the shark research results start to come in, for the next few years at least, Perth swimmers will be relying on old-fashioned technologies of binoculars and sirens to warn them of sharks. For DW, this is Kate Hairsine in Perth.
And if that doesn't make you want to go to the beach, I don't know what will. Sharks or no sharks. Unfortunately, that's all from Spectrum for now on DW. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. Listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfikar Abani. Our studio tech was Yaron Kutz. Join us next time if you can. Until then, thanks for listening and bye for now.